Good evening and welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crimes to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Block Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member who would like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, my friend and co-host Susan Murphy Milano has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her site at www.conqueringcancer.me. Tonight we're going to delve into white-collar crime with a discussion of the eConnect scandal. eConnect was established in 1997 to develop the usage of simple, inexpensive equipment that could be used from homes, offices, cars, and public locations, and which would enable the consumer to effect secure electronic commerce transactions by either credit cards, ATM cards, or value-added cards. These transactions were defined as perfect transactions in that they would enable the sender to personally, electronically, and remotely send financial electronic card transactions. However, on August 11, 2003, eConnect CEO Thomas S. Hughes pleaded guilty in federal court to 3 counts of securities fraud and 1 count of criminal contempt, for which he was sentenced to 8 years in prison. So what went wrong at eConnect during those 6 years that caused Mr. Hughes to end up behind bars? With me to answer that question is former eConnect insider Manny Vavileza. Manny, welcome to Crime Wire.
Well, thank you, Dennis. This is, I guess, a third appearance, actually, and a little longer one, so I am most honored tonight to be with you and with Dr. Bond. And I have never met Susan, who I know is fighting and fighting well, and I do want to tell all the people I know who are listening in to please go to that site and give support to Susan, and the more support, the better. But again, my honor to be here tonight.
Well, thank you, Manny, and we hope to be joined a little later by one of the investors, Judy Squires, who was an investor at eConnect. And also joining us to provide his expert analysis is Dr. Scott Bond. Dr. Bond is a professor of criminology, media expert and analyst, public speaker and author. He is an expert on criminal behavior and the motivations of criminals. He offers insights into various types of crime, including white-collar, state crime, bullying, domestic violence, sexual assault, and serial homicide. He is the author of Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and the U.S. War on Iraq, a critically acclaimed book on war, crime, and terrorism from Rutgers University Press. You can learn more about Dr. Bond by visiting his website at www.docbonn, that's docbonn.com. Professor Bond, welcome back to Crime Wire.
Well, thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here this evening.
And Manny, if you could get us started, I want to be the first to say I'm far from an expert. In fact, I know very little about securities fraud. So I want to be taking this as a chance tonight to learn about that type of fraud. And from you and your experiences at eConnect and Professor Bond and his experience in analyzing white-collar criminals, among others. So, Manny, why don't you start off and tell us the background on eConnect?
You know what I'll do? Because I'll be the quarterback here, to use an analogy. I'm going to hand off to the man who can crash to the line and take us to the goal line because of his expertise in the general area of white-collar crime. And if it's okay with you, Denny, I think once we get that foundation of the white-collar crime, then I'll be more than happy to jump in and start with 1997 with this company that was a couple of pennies and wound up at $22 a share, 21 and 7/8. They did it the old way back then, 7/8. So,
okay.
Do you mind if
that's
I hand the call off?
That I would be happy to jump in and give a little background on white collar crime. Sure, happy
Thanks.
To do it, Manny. And the case that we're talking about tonight, eConnect, is really a case about securities fraud primarily, and that is one particular type of white collar crime. What white collar crime really is, generally speaking, is crime that is perpetrated by people of relatively high status in society, and this is the key, is within the context of their occupation or profession. Okay, so we're talking about a corporate executive who is embezzling, stealing money from his own company. We're talking about an individual doing a Ponzi scheme, you know, like Bernie Madoff, or it could involve things like putting faulty products on the marketplace, products that are dangerous, things that hurt the environment, things that cause toxic waste or pollution to the environment. These are all things that fall in the area of white-collar crime. So white-collar crime is actually much broader than a lot of times people realize. And, in fact, it actually does a lot more harm to society every year than so-called street crime does. Street crime, it's estimated, and we actually have much better information about street crime than we do white-collar crime. Street crime is estimated to cost society anywhere between $5 and $10 billion a year. Now, that's no chunk,
wow.
You know, small chunk of change, but by comparison, white-collar crime is estimated to cost the country anywhere from $100 to several hundred billion annually. So
wow.
It's really dwarfed in comparison to white-collar crime, street crime, that is. And I should say that the term white-collar crime, I'm going to tip my hat to one of the legendary criminologists in U.S. history, a gentleman by the name of Edwin Sutherland, who was a very prominent researcher and professor at the University of Chicago, actually came up with the term white-collar crime in 1939. It had never been used before. And he wrote a famous book titled White Collar Crime a few years later, and so it became part of the vernacular. But up until 1939, the term white collar crime was never even used. And as I mentioned, there are financial costs to white collar crime, but there are also physical costs. People are injured every year and killed due to faulty products and faulty drugs and toxic waste and air pollution and water pollution, environmental hazards. And also, there's even an area that it's hard to put a parameters on this. It's hard to quantify it, but there's what I call moral harm as well, emotional or moral harm. When someone like Enron, or a situation like Enron takes place, or a Bernie Madoff and his Ponzi scheme, it causes cynicism, distrust in corporate America, distrust of the government. And how do you put a value on such cynicism and distrust in society? So that's yet another area of harm that is done that's really even hard to put a figure on. And so that's just a little backdrop. Hopefully that gives you a little perspective on white-collar crime.
Yeah, it sure does. Denny, you had also mentioned about possible suicides, and I'm sure that does happen. I was the one who would directly talk to the people who were investing in eConnect. I was the investor relations person, and I'll go into that in a couple of seconds, because probably many of my former students out there, I was a teacher at Lincoln High School for 34 years and taught about 4,000 students, are probably saying, but wait a second, Mr. V, you're a teacher. Well, Mr. V, after he taught, did go to this rather nefarious company, although Mr. Tabalitza had no idea. If we had Googling back in the year 2000, 2001, I would not have put my toe in the water. But I think, Denny, that your observation that it could lead to suicide is absolutely on target.
Absolutely. I would agree with that.
Yeah, Professor, let me just ask you what your response to this. Manny and I were talking about it before the show. I have heard people talk about criminals and criminal activity, and you mentioned white-collar crime. And I used to investigate white-collar, not securities fraud, but other forms of fraud. And they kind of scoff and think, well, you know, because the criminal isn't necessarily walking around with a Tommy gun or a 9mm, it really isn't a crime. You know, I mean, in order to commit a crime, you got to be armed and dangerous. And that almost as though white collar, when you say white collar, it's victimless, like there's no victims. How would you respond to people with that mindset that think there are no victims for white collar criminals?
Ask the victims of Bernie Madoff or the Enron debacle who lost their life savings if they think that white collar crimes are victimless.
Yeah, very good answer.
Very true. Very true. And the same goes for eConnect also. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible thing to talk to people who lost more than they should have. They borrowed money when the stock was at $4.21, and they saw it rise to $16, and they borrowed more money and to $22, and then bam, actually that was the second shutdown of the stock, but most lost all. Our guest who's coming later, Judy Squires, will tell you an interesting story. I call her half victim, and she'll explain that to you, but Dennis, yeah, your point is so salient. The victims are absolutely some of them without hope, despondent, and some perhaps even suicidal. You know, I'm looking through a couple of notes here, and we all know that famous quote, some attribute it to the Bible. I couldn't find it there. I always thought it was in the book of Timothy. Some attribute it to Plato in different words, but that money is the root of all evil. But actually, it's the love of money that is the root of all evil. And there, a sidelight is George Bernard Shaw and Mark Twain put a little twist on that, saying that the love of money is virtue. We, of course, have to know that they're being sardonic, I think. And the other half of this issue, Dr. Bond, that I wanted to ask you, is it fair of me to say it does take some greed on the part of the victim, and I phrase that very carefully and defer to you, in order for this white-collar crime to operate?
Sure. Well, that is, you know, that's why Ponzi schemes work. That's why con games work, because there's this magical allure of getting rich quick and the information that no one else has that you can cash in on. So that's it's part of the American dream. You know, the idea of striking out as an entrepreneur and striking it rich. So it ties in actually nicely with our value system. So yes, I completely agree with you that there is a little bit of greed and perhaps blind optimism naivete, if you will, on the part of the victims in some cases, but that doesn't mean that the acts themselves, the crime, is still not reprehensible. And a point that I wanted to add about white collar crime is there's not nearly as much known about it as street crime. And one of the reasons that there's not nearly as much known about it is the U.S. government, federal government, state and local governments spend a lot of money studying street crime, but they don't spend much money at all studying white collar crime. And I'll leave it up to you to surmise why that might be. But if white collar crime is committed by the rich and powerful, it's not necessarily in their best interest to study the crime that they do. As a matter of fact, you might go so far as to say, if they do it, it's not crime. I think Nixon said something to that.
His fingers up in victory, I believe. through innuendo, I'll just back you up by saying this about eConnect. eConnect was first under suspicion way before I even heard of it in 1997, actually. Some of its statements were questioned. But before I can do that, let me elaborate a little bit on the definition of what Denny gave for the mission statement, if you will, of eConnect. eConnect, I'm going to put this in lay terms. eConnect came up with a great idea. Its CEO, Thomas Hughes, was a genius. I was with Thomas Hughes in California many, 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 many times. He was a gentleman. Before I get into some negative, real negative aspects, he was good to me. He was good to the people around him. He thought he was being good to his investors. But his idea was this, and it was a great idea if he had only pursued it and not worried about the stock share price. His idea was to invent something called, well, eventually he called it an e-cash pad. It started out as an easy pay, easy cash, but eventually its name was the e-cash pad. And what it was able to do, at least on schemata, on paper, was to make a transaction direct from the buyer to the bank. Now, there are two really interesting things about this. Number one, let's think about this. If the buyer can go directly to the bank with his information, et cetera, and buy online a tent, well, then there's no chance of identity theft. And that wasn't even a phrase. It may have been, but who the heck knew about it in 1999? So this was a brilliant idea, and Mr. Hughes was pursuing this. The second aspect of what Mr. Hughes was pursuing, he was going to have these e-cash pads made in Asia, shipped to the U.S., disseminated to businesses, various online organizations, catalogs, et cetera, given to people in their home so that they could make these transactions in their home. And I have to say that is what drew me to the company, not knowing a lot of what was in the background with the stocks. If Mr. Hughes had pursued that e-cash pad and not worried about the price of the stock, and we'll get into pump and dump in a little while, I truly believe that company today would be a Fortune 500 company. But unfortunately, it was a house of cards that was built on false statements, and I would think, Scott, that this would be a very typical of a pump and dump scheme.
Sure. Well, misrepresentation is a big part of security scams. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I'll just give you a few examples that go as far back as 1999. And again, one wonders, doesn't accuse, certainly, why the powers that be didn't close it a lot sooner than March of 2000. And, for example, Mr. Hughes boasted of a sub-company called Sportsbet. And one of the branches of Sportsbet was 77wins.com. And several releases were put out by Mr. Hughes of how revenue was being generated from this. People even back in 1999 called for investigation, and there was. There was a private investigation by a company that basically said, now, wait a second, this 77wins hasn't generated 1 cent. Also, by the way, as a side note, and I think when we get Judy on, so, you know, if someone gets a call from Judy Squires, if we could make sure that, you know, it does get through. 77wins, the idea was that it would be okay to have this online gambling because, said Mr. Hughes, we're going to actually have it based in the Dominican Republic. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I said, Tom, I don't think it's legal wherever it is. And I badgered him, and he gave me the permission to go ahead and use the company funds, and I found one of the best gaming attorneys in Los Angeles. And I went to him. I was there about 10 minutes, and he said, Manny, you're right. No matter where the money goes, it's illegal. And I told that to Tom, but he continued to proselytize 77wins and more online gaming and how he had what he called a portal so that people wouldn't have to worry about, you know, getting in trouble for gambling, that the money would go directly to the Dominican Republic. And, you know, at this time in 1999, he was bragging about a Linux-based transaction server, safety pay, all part of the perfect transaction. Well, none of these existed. None of these really, and, you know, I didn't know. I was told that they existed. I believe this very charismatic man, and that's my next question to you, Scott, about the charisma of Mr. Hughes. Is that typical?
Well, certainly individuals like Bernie Madoff come to my mind, as well as Michael Milliken, you know, the junk bond king, could proverbially, you know, sell ice cubes to Eskimos, you know, had so much charisma.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, to this day, it's strange. The charisma was such that I almost feel bad that I'm not still his friend. One of the eConnect workers, I had contacted him, but he chose not to be on the show. And he said to me, but I thought you were Tom's friend, and I was. But I can't morally associate with the one who perpetrated so many of the things that we're going to get to in a little while. So many people. You know, the volume of this stock rose so much that the daily shares, I believe in one day we actually traded 1.8 million shares, and the American Stock Exchange called us. called eConnect. Tom sent me to New York, and I was taken on a tour of New York, which is ironic because actually I do live in New York. And the bottom line was he said to me, you know, we're very interested. Now, why weren't they doing their research? The only thing I can come up with is that all they were really interested in at that point, the American Stock Exchange, very prestigious, and we're not talking the pink sheets here now, was that our volume was so high. And am I correct to say, Scott, that they would get a percentage on that volume of shares traded?
That's not in my area of expertise.
Okay, well, let me put it this way. When I was kind of wined and dined, let's say, the number of shares traded was certainly the big topic. And it would seem to me that, you know, this stock was in the time now when it was soaring. You know, it hit $4, then $5 and $6. It was talked about everywhere. In fact, I'll add a little anecdote here. As it was soaring, before it was halted the first time at about $16 a share, as it was soaring, it became a phenomenon. And everywhere I went, you know, people would find out that I was investor relations. And, of course, the investor relations person cannot give any inside information. And I never did, as opposed to a person who would call Tom directly, and Tom would say, well, we're doing this, we're doing that. Don't tell anybody but. So wherever I would go, you know, I became well-known. My mom, I told this to Denny, my mom was sick in the hospital a little before the stock hit 16. So it was in the period it was soaring. The American dream come true. And my mother had been complaining to me in Italian that none of the nurses were paying attention to her in Good Samaritan Hospital in Rockland County, Suffern, New York. So I said, all right, Mom, I'll talk to somebody. And I talked to the head nurse, and she said, well, you know, we're trying. And she said, oh, your mother said that you work for eConnect? And I said, yeah. She said, okay, we'll try. I go back, I'm talking to my mother, et cetera. Within 2 minutes, there are two nurses, a nurse's aide, and three doctors in the room, okay, all invested in eConnect, all asking me questions, okay, and, of course, the rest of my mother's stay, she was kind of like Marie Antoinette before her head was taken off. So that shows you how popular a stock it had become.
Manny, yeah. Let me interrupt you just a second, and let's check with Kim and see if perhaps Judy has called in or we have any other callers.
Okay.
Yes, we have a caller. Barbara has called in, has a question for Manny, but we also have Judy Squires on the line.
Okay. Barbara's going to be pretty brief. I chose her to kind of represent my Lincoln High School students. So could we do Barbara first and then
let's do Barbara and keep it brief, and we'll go on to Judy. Thank you.
Sure.
Barbara?
Hi.
Welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hi, Mr. V.
Hello, Barbara. How are you?
I can't get Barbara
to call me Manny. You know, Barbara was in one of my first classes. I am so proud of Barbara, and that's why I picked her to represent my students. She'll ask a question in a while, so this way you wouldn't get, you know, 10, 20 calls. And Barbara was the one who, the week before last, wrote that letter on being bullied. And Barbara, like our Susan, is battling ovarian cancer, so we all send our prayers to her and she will conquer. I tell her that all the time. And okay, Barbara. Oh, one other thing. Barbara, in seventh grade, wouldn't do an oral book report, but I forced her to do it. I don't know if she's ever forgiven me, so I don't know if she'll say, no, we truly, truly have established a wonderful relationship. So, Barbara, go ahead.
I just wanted to know, how did you personally get imbibed in the eConnect?
Okay. And Barbara, thanks for asking that, because as I told you, you know, I'm going to get a lot of kids who are going to say, Manny, Mr. V, how'd you get into it? In about the year 1999, closer to 2000, a friend of my son's introduced me to the stock. I researched it a bit. Again, no Googling back in those days. And the ideas, eCashPad, et cetera, Barbara, they sounded great. And one day Mark said, well, call this Mr. Hughes. I said, I can't call the CEO of a company. Well, I did. And I have no idea why there was an immediate simpatico there. And Mr. Hughes would call me before I would go to school. Now, he would call me at about 6:30 in the morning, New York time, which means he was calling me about 3:30 a.m. in California. And he started to hint at, why don't you come and work for me? Now, I was the son of a stockbroker, yes. I did know something about the market, yes. But I didn't see myself at all fit to work for this company that seemed to have such vast potential. But the one thing I could do, and still I believe can do, is write and talk and be personable. And he said he was looking for an investor relations person. So after a few months, the Yonkers school system had offered, I believe, some kind of incentive to retire at 55. I grabbed it, Barbara, and went to work for eConnect on a commute basis, because I told Mr. Hughes that, you know, I live in New York. I can't move to California right now. And he said, well, listen, your investor relations will give them your number in New York, but I will be asking you to come out here frequently, which he sure did. So that's how it happened.
Thank you, Mr. V.
Okay, Barbara. Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Okay, Judy is ready at this point?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. How are you?
Oh, boy, it's just great to hear your voice.
Same here. Wow, it's a deja vu. For everyone out there, Judy, and she'll, of course, tell you the story, invested in eConnect. They became quite a good friend of eConnect, and her family was involved. Now, I called her a half victim at the beginning of the show. I think you know, Judy, what I mean. What did I mean by calling you a half victim?
Because I wasn't greedy. Basically, when
answer, go ahead.
When the stock started to rise, when it got around $4 a share, I got rid of about half of my stock just to get my money back out of it, because I didn't like the part about the e-betting thing, you know.
That was the red flag for you. Okay,
yes.
That's interesting. Go ahead.
Yes, and so I dumped half of it at $4 a share, and, of course, I'd only paid like a penny a share. And I had, I think, 4,000 shares at that time. And so,
wow.
You know.
Because that was $16,000 in your pocket.
Right.
And
right.
I want to, again, in case anybody just missed it or whatever, you said because I wasn't greedy.
Nope.
How about that?
Nope. I called my brother-in-law. I asked him.
Go ahead,
Judy. I said, have you sold any of yours? And he said, no, I'm waiting for it to go up. And I said, you really should get your money back out of it. I would really recommend that, you sold some of your shares. And he had many, many more shares than I had. And, in fact, he was the one who had introduced me to eConnect and had gotten me interested. And I had called Mr. Hughes myself and spoke with him and actually bought my first shares through him.
What did you think of Tom when you spoke to him?
He was very knowledgeable, very personable, seemed very sincere, very excited about the product, was able to explain to me exactly what it was going to do, and I became excited about it.
And I'm going to embarrass you a little bit here in a positive way, Judy. I think it's very important, especially for Scott, who is listening to us, and Dennis, to emphasize to everyone, Judy is a brilliant person. She is an extremely bright, this is the teacher in me, an extremely bright, actually I call her the Renaissance woman. So whether it be Shakespeare or the market, she's a very, very bright woman. So when we talk about somebody being scammed into it, I just want to emphasize that it doesn't mean that the people scammed are necessarily people who have, let's say, little education or no knowledge of the market, et cetera. Would you agree with me, Scott, on that?
Well, Bernie Madoff's client list is like a who's who of celebrities and influentials in America. So, yeah, there's people of means, people who are educated, people who are very well to do are taken every day. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, those who are taken advantage of are not necessarily, people who are simply naive or uneducated, that's for sure.
A point very, very well taken, and maybe to some, something for all of us to think about. Who was it, W.C. Fields, who said there's a sucker born every day? Well, we are all vulnerable. Judy, what is it that you said that you got your red flag with the sports thing. Okay, but what is it that you liked about the company that made you go out on a limb, even though it was a penny a share at that point, but what is it that you liked about it?
I just thought that it was very innovative. I had taken some courses, some computer courses, and just when computers were really just starting to come out where they had the desktops,
yeah.
And I was just very interested in, computers. And I had a computer at the time, and I was watching the stocks. I was reading Motley Fool,
Yes, let's explain to everyone out there. Most stocks, people read the press releases, et cetera, but of course the press release comes from the CEO. So a lot of stuff is disseminated through message boards, okay? These message boards are just kind of places where one posts their ideas on the stock. One was called the Raging Bull. Another was Silicon Investor, and there was one called the Motley Fool. Now, what did you think when people on those message boards, Judy, started saying, hey, Manny, Tom Hughes is a crook. You guys aren't making this much, that much, or the other thing. Did you read posts like that?
Oh, yes, I did, and I couldn't believe it. There was a young man, went by the name of Fat Matt, and he was a very brilliant 16-year-old.
Yeah, he sure was.
Yes, and he had gotten to be, you know, friends with me quite a bit, asking me whether he should get his girlfriend a corsage that he pinned on her dress or one that went on her wrist.
So you made a friend there, good.
Yes, yes. And he told me on there, and it wasn't until Matt told me about it that I really believed it.
And you still had half your shares at that time.
Right.
Okay. Now, there, the messages became angrier and angrier, and then, of course, we were shut down. eConnect was shut down, I guess, when it was about $16 a share.
Correct.
And the SEC began to investigate certain things. And just let me mention a few of them. Thomas Hughes had put out a press release about something that was called the Palm Pilot. And the company that produced this Palm Pilot, Mr. Hughes said, had an agreement with him, a contract. Well, the SEC investigated and found out that, indeed, when they called up this company, the company said, well, Mr. Hughes called us up, but we don't have any agreement whatsoever. Mr. Hughes had made it sound like the company was bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's according to, you know, what post you read, et cetera. Because basically most of the information that came from Manny Vavalitza was just dictated by Tom. And that's another thing that I'm glad that I can say that in this show. Your boss tells you that, you know, the money is just pouring in. Well, when the 10Q, which is, okay, that is like a tax form, a reporting form, came in, it showed that the company had assets of $44,000, but it had liabilities, I believe, of $780,000. And it was approaching $1 million and growing that liability factor every day. So all of this stuff was coming out on the various message boards. And to kind of wrap it up, because I think this is a great story, what happened with you in the end, the final day of eConnect when it hit 21 and 7/8?
When that happened, of course, my stockbroker had called me, and she said, do you know that the stock has hit, you know, at that time it was something like 18-something, do you want to sell it? And I said, no. I said, I think that even if this company dies, somebody's going to pick this up. You know, somebody was going to pick it up, and they were going to run with it. And, you know, at that time, I had heard about you. I had heard about Rex. And, you know, I was hoping that somebody would, you know, turn this around. Maybe his son. I heard he had a son. And, And, you know, I just had hope that this would, you know, come to fruition because we were running a restaurant at the time. I had not gone to nursing school yet, and we were running a restaurant, and I was working, you know, probably 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I wanted time with my family. I wanted, my husband to be able to quit his job and be with us. He was working in the oil fields, and, you know, it was just part of the dream.
Yeah, that is what the professor, the word the professor had used also, the American dream. Here it was right in front of you, so stockbroker says, hey, it's 18. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
What did you do? So you held on at 18, and?
I held on at 18, and I hadn't intended to sell at whatever price. I was just going to hang on to it.
So when it hit 21 and 7/8, what was your reaction when it was shut down?
Oh, my heart fell to my feet. I mean, I just, you know, I knew that something was wrong. I knew by the post. I knew by what Matt had told me that, you know, there was a lot of dishonesty going on. But, you know, you just have this hope against hope. And I had already gotten my money back and then some, you know. So I wasn't really too worried about the rest of it. You know, I thought if this goes south completely, I'm good. I'm not, I'm not hurt by it, except for, you know, not having the dream come true.
Well, you almost got there, Judy. I'm going to thank you very, very much. It is a paradigm of, you know, what could have been at 18, and I understand so much, and we've become such good friends, the feelings that, you know, churn up in you. But at the same time, you do present a very greed-less person in that you did sell your 4,000 shares and were able to say, hey, I made my money back and a little more. Judy, thank you so much for being on. I see time is just flying by here, so we'll see if anyone else is on the line. Or
thank you for inviting me.
Oh, Judy, thank you so very much, because that story tells it all. Thank you.
Okay. We'll catch you later.
Okie doke.
Good night.
That is a sad story, and yet not a sad story. Many stories, Scott and Dennis, were did not have as good an ending as that one. And as you can imagine, on these message boards, the Raging Bull, Silicon Investor, Motley, Manny became persona non grata. No matter how many times it was explained that I was not privy to any of this stuff that was going on, that Tom, he would dictate the press releases or put them out on his own and not even tell me. Many times that happened too. So you can imagine all of these people who invested at $14, $15, $12, et cetera, whose lives were destroyed, as you mentioned, Scott. It's not a victimless crime at all.
No, clearly not. Now, in Judy's case, it's wonderful that she is able to get out and actually made herself a profit. And but that's a testimony to her intelligence, the research that she did, followed it very closely, and the fact that, as you said, Manny, she's clearly just not a greedy person. You know,
that made the big difference, and that might be something, Professor, for all of us to think about, because it's the thing that gets us, you know, we get a little money at the roulette table there, but come on, we can do it one more time, and no matter what the field might be, it's that greed thing that seems to bring us down. And also, I might even add, you know, if it sounds too good, it just might be too good, because
that's a good rule of thumb
company. Now, I would like to tell the story here also of how things ended for Manny Zavalitza.
Manny?
Yes.
Manny, before you get into that, I think we have another caller. Kim?
Oh, let's take the caller, sure.
Yes, Manny, we have a caller. She has a question from you. Her name is Chandra, and she's from New York. And Chandra, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you. Yes, I was wondering, with all this going down on eConnect, I was wondering how it affected you and your family.
Oh, wow. good question. Thank you. Well, actually, you timed it perfectly because I was about to tell the story. The stress towards the end was indescribable. My wife and I, we were pretty sure, but not certain, and being careful here with every word, that our phone was being tapped. I was receiving death threats. I became, for a while anyway, the scapegoat. We were waiting for the SEC, whatever, to come to the door, and one day a car pulls up, black car with no white walls, a good sign in those days, and two gentlemen in suits get out, and, you know, I said to my wife, this is it. And they came and knocked on the door, and they were Jehovah's Witnesses, thank God. that was not to be for very long. I was summoned by the FBI to leave New York immediately, and come to Los Angeles to be interrogated by the FBI. And two gentlemen in suits, very expensive suits, did just that. It was the obvious good cop, bad cop. There literally were lights in the room. I was being videotaped. There was a stenographer in the room. And a question would be asked, and 2 minutes later, the same question would be asked, and the same question. After about 5 hours of interrogation, okay, with buckets of sweat around me, finally the younger of the two gentlemen, actually the bad cop one, said to me, do you know why you're not in trouble? I sighed, and I said, why, sir? And he said, one, you didn't sell your shares at 22 or 16. I had sold half my shares at 100,000, but I think it was like at $4, like Judy said. There was, you know, there was not a greed factor in there. And he said, secondly, he said, you never gave out insider information. You never said anything like, I guarantee you this stock is going to go up. Okay? So you were not, we feel you were not part of the pump and dump, and I don't even know if we have time to go into that, which took this stock from one penny. Didn't Judy say she bought it at one penny? From one penny to almost $22. So they shook my hand. I was revisited by them almost a year later about a gentleman who from the outside pumped this stock up. His profession was a tree trimmer, but he pretended to be a market analyst. And he said this was a $50 stock, a $100 stock, etc. And eventually he went to jail too.
Manny, can I just interrupt here a second? Now, did you ever actually have to testify against Mr. Hughes? There was no real trial at all, right? Now, was he pled out?
Yes.
So you didn't have to start a trial, and then so you never actually had to testify.
I did have to sign a testimony. Would it be called a deposition? Would that be the proper name of it? I did have to sign a testimony that he had told me some bonds that we had were double A, meaning they were good and negotiable. Okay? They were not double A. They were garbage. Okay? I did have to testify. That is what put Mr. Hughes in jail. So I did not have to appear at any trial. I don't even know if there was a trial because he pled guilty.
Right.
It was hard, very difficult towards the end. It was very, very difficult.
I'm assuming, and the professor here can comment on this, I'm assuming that maybe one of the reasons he pled guilty was because of your deposition and what other evidence they had, where he probably could maybe felt he'd get, I guess he had 8 years, maybe he felt he was facing a little more than that if he went to trial, and he probably, through discovery and so forth, realized there was a lot of stuff against him. What do you think?
Good, Dennis, right on target. It would have been 20 years. It would have been 20 years.
They probably offered him a deal, too. I'm sure that, once the evidence was laid out in front of him, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he was offered some sort of a deal, plead guilty in exchange for, lesser charge or something.
Yeah, because it was my testimony that he told me they were double-A bonds that basically buried him, because it was easy to find out. They were nothing. They were junk, non-negotiable bonds. He was nailed.
I want to, before, because we're running out of time here very quick, how does a person, and Manny, I'd like you to comment on this, and also Professor Bond, how does a person keep from getting scammed? I realize that no matter how careful you are, there might be, I think, a Newman and Redford in the Sting movie. I suppose there are real slick ones out there that no matter how careful you are, you might get grabbed. But is there any way that you can make yourself a very tough target?
You know something, Dennis? In 1999, if there was this little thing called Google, as I said, I never would have put my toe in the water. Today, investors can do their homework. And that's why with Mr. Madoff, it is rather baffling how that Ponzi came to fruition, because today, you can do your homework. It's all there, everything. But get it from the right source. Get it from the SEC. Get it from the police department if that's the area you're going in. Homework.
And I would also add to that, if, as Manny said earlier, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And but, yes, there's nothing like the information to before you open up your wallet, and ask to speak to other investors, especially in situations that are highly, highly speculative at the very early stages. Ask to talk to other individuals who have already made an investment and see how they feel about it, and do they actually exist? Just because you're handed with a piece of paper that says people have invested in it, it's good to actually talk to them and find out for sure.
True, very true.
Let me ask you this on that note. If by doing your homework, as Manny says, or being prudent, if you ask for a list of investors and so on, and they refuse to pass them out, should that be a real red flag to you?
Huge, huge red flag.
Yes. Yes. Again, Tom had this charisma, this charm. But there were people who read him from the beginning, and believe me, he would not give you their name. So it's a tremendous, as Scott said, a tremendous red flag. Beware. Something good is not too good, and it's out in the open. There's nothing to hide.
Gentlemen, I hate to say it, but we're down to our last few seconds. We're going to have to wrap it up. Manny, thanks so much for coming on tonight and sharing the story. And Professor Bond, thank you for adding your analysis.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
And also, thanks to the Crime Warrior team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be on Tuesday, August 14th, when my co-host will be Crime Warrior consultant and statement analyst Peter Hyatt. Remember, be sure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Warrior team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
God
good night, Manny. Bye-bye, Professor.
Bye, Professor. Bye, Dennis.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Kim.
Good night, Denny.
Bye-bye.